Hello, everybody. It's Eddie. Glad you're with us tonight. Got Mr. Mangan with us.
Good evening, Eddie. Everybody.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Very good. Got Matt on the boards with us.
Yep. Hello.
And so, you know, we might as well just get this out of the way right now, Charles.
Okay, Eddie, what's that?
Well, I don't know if you know this, but they have the national championship badminton tonight. I mean football.
Oh, okay, I think so. Okay.
And so, you know, we tape these, right, Mangan?
No, we tape these, Eddie.
And that means it'll be forever of record.
That's not always a good thing.
So we're gonna let Matt predict the score.
Oh, we're gonna let Matt do it. Good. Okay, Matt. Remember, this is gonna be recorded now, Matt.
Oh, yeah. That's how this works.
This is going to be all you, Matt.
Right now, Matthew. What's the score right now?
Right now it's 7-7. Clemson just tied it up.
Clemson and what's that little junior college over in Alabama?
I think it's University of Birmingham or something.
Yeah, I thought it was. They're going to get – if they win this one, they're going to like make them a four-year school, I think.
Yeah, I think that was probably the criteria.
You want to make a prediction, Matthew? It's going to be of record.
Yeah, 42-36 Clemson.
14-36?
42-36.
Oh, you think it's going to be – okay, it's going to be a touchdown away and Clemson's going to take it.
I think so.
All right, we'll check with you later in the presentation.
I've got it on my phone. I'm watching it.
All right. So, look, we got a lot of good stuff to cover tonight. Just thought we'd have a little fun with you guys to get started. So, let's roll with it, Matthew.
All righty. So, first up, we do have Roman. So, I'm going to go ahead and get Roman unmuted. Go ahead, Roman.
Hi, yo.
Hey, Roman.
How are you?
How are you, sir?
Hanging in there. Got one eye on the game as well, so.
All right. Well, I agree with Matthew's prediction. You think that's
I shall remain neutral.
We don't allow that.
Ohio State's not playing, so it doesn't matter.
Oh, just have a little fun with you, Roman.
I hear you.
All right. Tell us what you got, my friend.
This is a note. Part of talking to local investors, and this is another one of those, I think the term you put it last week was they rehab and then they sell to with seller financing, and they're always real proud of how creative they are, and this is another creative one. Note was originated in November of this past year, so it's a brand new note. And as you can see on the terms here, it's kind of creative. I did a little search on this property. It's just a two-bedroom, one-bedroom ranch. Chesterland, Ohio is a preferred area. It's a outreading suburb of Cleveland, usually has a little more land on it, which is, you can see this has a 1.25-acre lot. Mm-hmm. It's nothing special. It's at the bottom of the market as far as single families in this area. But it's the cheapest house that's sold in Chesterland over the last year. It was an estate, and I did send Matt the old MLS with the full photo essay so you can have an idea of what the interior looks like. It's not all beat up. It's not chewed up. But he bought it in August of 15, turned around and sold it with seller financing in November, was the first payment was due, for $52,000. And he takes $30,000 down and has an interest-only payment of $250 a month for 5 years. Which at the end of the end of 5 years, there's a balloon payment of $52. I did a CMA on it because I have access out there. So, conservatively, a two-bedroom, you know, and he's, you know, with the idea. Now, this is all as a result of a meeting with this particular investor. And he tells me that the guy who bought it is doing improvements to the property. That's why the creative term, so he has money to do improvements. And conservatively, it should be worth in the low to mid-70s by the end of this year. Is this safe, something?
Safe, solid area.
Absolutely. Oh, rock solid.
Is this guy a dealer?
That's a question that you brought up last week, so I looked into it. He hasn't officially responded to it. I did some preliminary research on the two LLCs that I know he owns, and between the two, he's got 21 properties in his name. Did some research on some of that stuff. It doesn't appear so. I don't think he's doing more than 3 a year.
How do you figure that?
He's not, I had lunch with the guy, and that's why I've learned about the couple of notes that he's created. Business model is buy and hold. He wants rentals, because our initial meeting was based on a 50-50 meeting. And then we started talking about notes because he wanted to know more about them.
All right. Well, there's two things I would say. Obviously, if he's creating owner financing and he's not compliant with Dodd-Frank, meaning that he has dealer status, that mm-hmm. his combined entities sells and finances more than three houses to a consumer a year. More than three.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The second thing is, if he's subject to Dodd-Frank, the balloon is a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Because Dodd-Frank says that the customer would have to qualify for their payments as if the loan were level amortized. So they'd have to qualify as if the loan was a fully amortizing 5-year note. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So the Dodd-Frank scenario with this is pretty critical.
Definitely.
Not just because he needs to be compliant, but the balloon might not be enforceable otherwise. The other thing is, he created a very low monthly payment, $250 a month.
Mm-hmm. And none of it's going towards principal.
Yeah, it's just paying for the right to have the loan, so to speak. It's interest only.
Mm-hmm.
And it bites into the economics of the deal a little bit because it's a low payment. Now, when you're dealing in working class property, they're not going to be a payment of $700 a month, right?
Correct.
But so how many payments has the customer made?
According to the buyer, I have no documentation on this. This is all emails going back and forth.
I got it. Yeah.
Three.
He do any credit underwriting of the buyer?
He does not have his documentation, or at least during the conversations that we've had and the emails going back and forth, I haven't seen any documentation yet. That's why it's my real question to you guys is, This is so out of left field. Is this worth pursuing?
Something? Oh, hell yeah. Like, I paid $30,000 down.
Yeah.
I mean, and it's apparently a very good area because you got a two-bedroom, one-bath house that you say would be worth $70,000. I didn't think there was a house in Ohio worth $70,000. It's two-bedroom.
Only the places you go.
So, you see, on one hand, you know, I'm very critical about one scenario, making sure they do it right. And on the other hand, it's kind of like, shit, they paid $30,000 down.
Mm-hmm.
Cowboy common sense has got to weigh in sometimes.
And if you do the numbers just straight up, after 5 years, he sells this place for $67,500. He collects $15,000 over 5 years with a $250 a month payment, and then the guy still owes him $22,000 at the end. Yeah, and he sells his $37,500 investment for $67,000.
I'm not buying that, those economics. I mean, interest is payable in arrears, right? That means they got to collect the money. And that means time has to pass. So it's multiplying payments well out in the future. I wouldn't say that would be somewhat meaningless to me.
Okay.
But I mean, if I were selling to somebody, it would be, but not if Martha and I were sitting there talking about a deal amongst ourselves. The problem is, it's, you know, I mean, if I he's either, he's just got to be compliant. He's either compliant or he's not.
Okay.
I mean, if he's not subject to Dodd-Frank, he's fine. If he's subject to Dodd-Frank, do you want to take a swing at it? I don't know.
No. Mm-mm. No. No.
It would have to be risk-based pricing. Can we agree on that?
Definitely.
And, you know, the problem is the enforceability of the documents. Otherwise, credit, all that stuff would weigh into it. But he's got enough skin in the game. It's a viable deal. Now, what's it worth?
Yeah, what's it worth?
To me, $0.70, $0.68. I mean, that's on the top side.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if I sold it to you, if I packaged it, did all the due diligence, put it together, bought it, pulled all this stuff together, and I sold it to you as just a student that wanted to pull it off the shelf, would I sell it to you for 70 cents? No. I'm not. This is not a nonprofit organization. So if I go do all the filtering and sifting and do all that kind of stuff, and I just sell it to a passive investor, I'm probably going to sell it to them and try to make a little bit. But hell, what the heck? If I made 10 points, I make $2,500.
Mm-hmm.
You see what I'm saying? I can't make that much money. That's the problem with it. It's just a small note. There's just not a huge amount of margin in it.
If numbers worked out, would you park it in your IRA?
For sure. And you could sell a partial. You could payments up to the balloon and part of the balloon and keep part of the balloon. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
You bet. All right, Mr. Matt, what's up?
All right. Excuse me. Next up, we've got Bob. So let me pull him in here. Bob, I think you have yourself muted if you want to unmute yourself.
There we go.
Hey, Bob.
Hey, how you doing, Eddie?
It's all good. How are you, sir?
Right. Looking forward to seeing you when you're back in Phoenix in a couple weeks.
I know. We're going to have a fun time.
Yeah. Always good.
All right. What we got, my friend?
What we have here is a gentleman who sold a note in Independence, or he sold a home with financing in
all right.
Independence. He sold it for around 100. He's looking on 25 years. He's looking to sell the first 20 years for about $70,000.
So, okay, so help me, Bob, again. Tell me the terms on the sale again.
It was, he sold it for $100,000. The finance amount was 95.5, I think. 25 years, 9%. And there's a picture that Matt's got up.
Okay.
So it's kind of interesting because there's no inside pictures, no interior pictures. Usually I've found in life that everything you see, there's a reason, and everything you don't see, there's a reason. So my guess is it's not real fresh. It looks like it was probably a HUD home because it looked up NARRPR and they have a value of about $58,000 on it and show the owner is Secretary of Housing and Urban Development.
All right, so we don't, I mean, we're going to have to presume it's worth $100,000, right? I mean, we have to make some assumptions here.
Yeah.
So if I bought 10 years for $70,000, what's my yield?
Well, actually, he's looking to sell 20 for 70, and it comes out to be about 12.25%.
I wouldn't do that. Personally, I wouldn't do it. I'm not saying you can't sell it to somebody. You can't sell it to me.
No. So that was my question is, what would be a good offer on this?
Well, I probably wouldn't buy a partial for much more than about 12 years. I might go 15, but, you know, and just to tell you, I mean, once again, this I'm just being a zillion percent transparent. For me to buy it internally, I either got to keep it or sell it. Okay? If I got to sell it, I got to make a profit.
Mm-hmm.
Right? If I got to keep it, I got to get enough juice in my return to do it. See, and say I happen to operate a shop that probably sees about 150 or 200 of these notes a year, 12% yield doesn't really juice me up.
Sure.
I mean, now, we got students on the call that they're going, well, hell, Eddie, you're selling me a note at 12% yield. I know, and I'll swap overhead with you. I'll sell you, if you pay my overhead, I'll sell you the notes at whatever I get to buy them for. You see what I'm saying? I mean, somewhere in the deal, in the buying and selling business, you got to make a profit. But
yeah, I get that.
But to me, if I were you trying to buy this note from someone, I'd back off and buy 10 years at probably a 14 yield.
Okay.
And, you know, once again, if he bought it and did a fix and flip and he didn't, you know, do anything to the inside, I mean, you just got to dig around. Let me make sure you understand something. Just because you put out a price and just because you put on a contract doesn't mean you're obligated to close. I usually let people gotcha. Walk in the freezer and tell me how good it is, and then I start doing my due diligence.
Yeah.
That would be my strategy. How'd you find this guy?
Okay. Bigger Pockets. He's just a contact I made.
Okay.
So you think it would be reasonable?
Remember, I can build some profit centers in there between what type of a contract I use, whether I buy it or sell it. If I bought mm-hmm. this thing from him, I'd build a prepayment penalty in it if it paid off early. You know, So the way you paper it and the way you contract it, there's a little potential juice in there that you don't see right on the surface. This guy knows enough to be dangerous. He understands what a partial is, and he understands how to run a financial calculator, and so he's going to come up with a number. That doesn't mean he's an expert. We are experts.
Okay.
But on the surface, it's just not – I mean, how many payments has been made on the note?
I don't even think they made the first one, so, you know, I mean, it's pretty green.
Okay, well, then that's a whole other subject. I thought the loan was seasoned. I mean, why? Unless the guy's got a 650 credit score, why do you buy it? What? I mean, he's got 5% skin in the game, right? He's trying to sell you another 70% investment to value. Hell yeah, I'd sell it. Would I buy it? Not unless I got some redeeming factors.
Well, that's why I wanted to bring it up, is I'm trying to figure out, you know, what is an appropriate offer. And it sounds like 10%, 14%, maybe go up to 15%.
First of all, Mr. Note Seller, tell me how good the deal is. What kind of financial package do you have on the buyer, and what's his credit rating? How did you vet the buyer to make sure he can pay?
You know, he did say he ran a Dodd-Frank compliance on the buyer, but I don't know if the buyer is
just great. I got it. That's great. Now tell me if the guy's going to pay.
Yeah.
I mean, okay, now we have a legally enforceable debt. Now let's see if the guy's going to pay that legally enforceable debt. With no payments made and 5% down, you'd have to, you got to have something. You got to be some, bones in here work somewhere.
Okay.
It's a great question. Now, let's say that he comes back and goes, well, I didn't really do a lot of due diligence and whatever. Then all of a sudden you're like, okay, well, what would I be willing to pay for a non-performing note until it proves itself as a performing note? And then I could do an installment purchase based on a partial.
Okay.
I'll give you $40,000 after a successful pay history for 2 years. I'll give you another $25,000 or whatever. I'm just making up numbers.
Gotcha.
Everything that when we keep talking about this stuff, whether it's Roman's deal or whether it's your deal, this is all like getting down to the specifics of redeeming factors. You know, and that's what I love. Like, I like doing this on these calls because it really gets to the art of the deal. Like, when can you live with it? So that's what I do. Think there's something in the middle of bigger pockets?
Pardon?
I mean, you've done a lot of stuff on bigger pockets. Do you see there being potential there helping your business?
To a limited extent, yeah.
Finding investors, finding people you could sell assets to, buy assets from. Where do you think the juice is in it?
Actually, I've found some people that we've done deals with in other cities.
Okay.
People that know markets, know how to, and have rehab capability, but don't have funds, and don't necessarily work the note side of the business. So we just partnered on one in Fort Wayne a couple weeks ago. Bought it back at end of November, where a guy found a property for 46. We bought it. We rehabbed it, which was a really light rehab, and we've got it listed for rent or sale right now. And we think the exit on that is 80 or 85.
Very good. Now, listen. It is by far the most populated chat forum in the real estate investor space. There's no argument about it. And I'm just always curious to kind of ask somebody that's out there kind of banging around on it what they see and think. All right, does that make sense to you? In other words, You got to ask more questions. You got to find out how redeeming factors it is. If the buyer's not vetted, you ain't got a deal, unless you're just going to back off and price it at a non-performing note price until it proves itself to be performing. Got bad credit? They got 5% down. You just got to price it as an NPL until it proves itself otherwise. Now you could do that in stages. You could tie up and buy 12 years or whatever, 15 years. Make one installment, and once they successfully pay a certain period of time, make the other installment. But you can't fund the whole amount up front, because if you funded that and the buyer has bad credit, not a huge amount down, where's the redeeming factors that says, I feel really comfortable they're going to pay?
Okay. Question for you. If you do that installment concept and the buyer does go bad on you, am I just basically – a first position lien holder, I just did a discount?
Yeah. And once again, you can gain some advantage with the different partial agreements. You can have a much tighter partial agreement on the buy side than you would if you were selling on the other side.
Yep.
Couple of questions people ask. Let's say the seller has a season note with no credit underwriting. Can you suggest a reduction in the yield to offset that? And Jackie asked that. Well, I think, Jackie, the issue is, it's a little bit like, have you reached a threshold or have you not reached a threshold? And in my case, weak down payment, weak credit, no pay history. It's like you take one of these working class deals and they paid 24 payments. Then all of a sudden their pay history kind of overrides their credit, right? In this case, they don't have a pay history, so if they have weak credit, there's nothing to override. Next thing is, John asked, would seller recourse help with the deal? No.
Been down that road.
Charles, does that work?
That does not work, Eddie.
How many land developers have used to say with a big, deep voice, well, I'll recourse it?
We had quite a few of those in the old days, Eddie. I remember we had several of those.
Recourse from a broke operator means that they're both broke, the borrower and the guy who recoursed it.
Yep.
Just our life experience has been, I wouldn't put any value in that. Believe me, John, you suggested it's a good idea, because trust me, Charles and I, Mangan and I have already tried it. So we thought it's a good idea, too.
And not just once or twice. We tried it a lot.
We did. Yeah.
It just took us a few years to learn, didn't it, Eddie?
I've had them assure me, you can come get my grand youngins if I default on this deal. All right. They're going to ride in the front seat of the back.
On the hood.
Teresa asked, does RMLO qualifying mean anything towards seasoning quality? Has nothing to do with it. It's just as simple as this. The RMLO is a compliant loan, and it's legally enforceable. You're either pregnant or you're not. It's either enforceable or it's not enforceable. Now, it's all enforceable unless somebody kicks back, right? You can foreclose on somebody that you're not compliant with until they complain. So you're just playing the odds they're not going to complain. And I don't know what – people say, what are those odds? I don't know. I mean, if I could give a ridiculous price to somebody, would I be willing to buy a non-compliant loan? I might be. I wouldn't sell it to one of you guys and act like I didn't understand the difference. All right. Great question, Mr. Bob. Look forward to seeing you in sunny Phoenix.
Thank you very much, Eddie.
Bet. All right, Mr. Matt. I know we got some servicing issue questions. So, Mr. Mangan, I know you're fixing to take the reins here, cowboy.
All right.
Let me see if Ed's on here. I do not see them on the phone. So, Ed, if you are under a different name, go ahead and raise your hand or have someone else raise your hand. But this is a question I think they may go back and listen to it in the archive. So I'll just go ahead and read it real quick and let y'all kind of handle this. So if they're purchasing something through auction.com and they were wondering how you can use if you can use a self-directed IRA. So per Equity Trust, due to the fact that credit card must be used to register for the auction, which is a $2,500 hold, until all the documents are signed and the hold would then be released, would that contaminate a self-directed IRA? And is there a correct way to bid on a property that you would have to put a down payment from a credit card in a self-directed IRA?
All right. Matt, there's a few people that I think are probably on the call. Lisa, probably, I don't know if Robin's on, but there's some people that are, I consider, top shelf self-directed IRA knowledgeable folks. And if anybody wants to, I threw this on here. I don't know the answer to this. I've never bought an asset off auction.com. Now, I'm supposedly fixing a bid on 600, so I guess I'm old. But I'm not going through the normal gates. And
Lisa and Robin both unmuted. If you guys want to go ahead and speak, or you ladies want to go ahead and speak to this,
I've never bought from auction.com. I've bid on stuff before, and I've never done it with my IRA. I guess I would question just how. So the $2,500 is what? Is it like a hold? Or is it like a deposit? I mean. You know, I'd want to know really are they processing your card or are they just holding it? Because if they're just
they don't run the credit. What they do is put a hold on the card. It's just a deposit. Once you buy the asset, a couple different ways they may do it, Robin. Okay, so I know Hudson and Marshall actually, they either run it on your card or you have to send them a cashier's check.
Yeah.
For the deposit. Then once you buy and you're the successful bidder and the paperwork's done, then they apply that towards the purchase price. Okay, so the question I guess is if you put the $2,500 on your credit card and they run it as a payment or run it as a hold, just as a down payment or a hold,
right?
Is Equity Trust going to refund that $2,500 to you out of your IRA?
That would be a hell no.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Yeah. I mean, you could
figure out how to do it. Robin, I could make a deal with you.
Yeah.
You put up your credit card, and if it's successful, I could pay you a fee for doing it. I could pay you $500 for doing it. Okay.
That's what I was going to say, Eddie. Just get somebody else that you know that you have a relationship with and let them put up their card and then –
All right, so Robin, you're not in my lineage, okay?
Right.
Meaning that you're not my spouse, my kids, my parent, you know, mm-hmm. parent or children, right?
Right.
And I don't own a business with you. You're not an employee. You see what I'm saying? All of that checklist of things that says you really can't do business with me with my IRA. Okay, so yeah. I can do business with you in my IRA. And theoretically, Robin, I could do this in my and I could personally own the piece that's $2,500 personally, and my IRA could own the difference. Right now, that's not prohibited.
No.
But it's not prescribed.
Right, exactly.
So I'm not going to – Robin is not going to tell you to do that, and I'm not going to tell you to do it. I would say, Charles, you got to go find a friend to do it. And I would not loan you the money, Charles, to do it out of my credit card because you work for Note School and Colonial. Okay?
Right.
Martha can't do it. Wood and Hudson can't do it, right? Now, can I go find your brother to do it or whatever? Yes.
Yeah. And, you know, these days you can buy those prepaid credit cards. So why don't you get, you know, your brother-in-law, you give him the $2,500, he puts the prepaid credit card in his name, and you put that up.
Well, I wouldn't say that out loud.
Well,
I'm not saying it doesn't happen. I'm sorry about this. Sometimes I forget to unplug my. Oh my gosh! Hold on. Sometimes I forget to turn the phone off in my office. Okay. So, could you get Equity Trust to do a prepaid credit card so you could bid on it?
I don't think they would do that. Because anything with your IRA has to be non-recourse, and a credit card is not non-recourse.
That's a good point.
So I don't think that they would.
Would they accept something other than a credit card? Would they accept a $2,500 cashier's check?
Well, that or a line of credit. Something like that.
That's debt.
Well, yeah, but maybe, again, not your line of credit. You have to get somebody that you could, you know, work a relationship with, and your name's not going to be on it.
You know what Lisa said, Robin?
What?
Lisa said, I don't have a bike, but picture myself explaining this to the IRS.
Well, if anybody could, Lisa could.
I don't know. I think she's saying that she's not really totally confident in that ability.
I would go back to auction.com and just tell them, ask them. There's got to be other people out there that have wanted to do things with their IRA and just see what other options they have besides the credit card.
Yeah, I threw it up because like I said, I actually am working on a deal, and it's somewhat remote, but it may happen where they've got a package and I'm kind of going in a different lane completely than just the normal go on their website and bid. But I don't know. I mean, I've not ever bought an asset on auction.com. I know lots of current and former employees of auction.com. But I just threw it up because I thought somebody might know the answer to it.
I don't know.
I think I agree with you, Robin. I think I just reach out to them and say, look, this is where my money's at. I can produce an earnest money check for $2,500, but I can't – can't mix my personal credit card and then act something that relates to my IRA account and just kind of see where they go. If you totally hit the wall on this, I do know somebody at auction.com really well. And if you don't get the right answer, then let me know and I'll see if I can I'll make an email introduction to you or something and let you see if you can deal with them. Roman says he doesn't think you can make an offer without credit card.
Yeah, they're going to require some type of deposit.
Yeah. Yeah, several people are suggesting debit cards, so I don't know. I mean, a debit card or a prepaid credit card really be the same thing. When you have a prepaid credit card, do you sign the – you don't sign any debt. You just put the money up and have a prepaid card, right?
Yeah, there's no debt because you've already put up the money.
Yeah, that's really a debit card, correct? That's not really technically a credit card.
No, I don't think it is. I mean, yeah, debit card.
All right, well.
Yeah, the only thing with debit cards, you can tie it back to somebody.
All right, so, Robin, once again, from an IRA standpoint, based on your, things that you've experienced, and, there's a circle of students that have been way down the road with training and IRA stuff, and you certainly are one of those. I think you and I would say you just don't mix the money with your personal credit card and an IRA investment.
I would not.
That is, by the way, guys, that is not absolutely prohibited.
It's not worth the hassle.
It's like Lisa said. Describe, take a picture of yourself like how you would explain it to the IRS. Yeah. Thanks, Robin.
Okay, thanks.
All right, Matthew. It's a good question, by the way, Ed. Very good question.
All right.
Yeah, what was the question?
I think make sure Keith's good to go.
Hello, can you hear me?
Hey, Keith, what's up, brother?
Oh, just blowing and going, trying to do more of the same.
All right.
Looking for a new year to do some big stuff.
I got you. Me too. All right, well, you got the captain of servicing on the line with you tonight, Mr. Mangan, so I'm going to let him run with this.
Sounds great. Still working on this parcel, talked about a week or two ago. Something came to mind that if the debtor does not maintain hazard insurance, normally the note holder will pay it. And start thinking about that. That would mess up your yield, something fierce. So I'm wondering, in reference to the seller finance notes, what we could do about it.
Okay, so let me frame it up. Let me frame it up, Charles, before you respond to it. Okay.
All right.
First of all, Keith, just to make sure the audience is straight about this, it doesn't matter if you bought a full or a partial in this scenario, right? You're just buying the right to receive payments, and you're a secured creditor.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, so full or partial is irrelevant. And you're saying that you're buying a seller finance note, and you just, like, hypothetically said, what if he lets the insurance lapse, and now I got to pay the insurance, and now all of a sudden it's coming out of what would have been my principal and interest payment?
Correct.
All right, Charles, how does that really work?
Okay, so if the borrower does not – Okay, first of all, let me ask you this. Is the loan being escrowed for taxes and insurance or not?
No.
Okay.
It's not being escrowed.
For either one.
There's no escrow for taxes or insurance, and you just discover a year or two later that the insurance has lapsed for whatever reason. And obviously, you want to maintain insurance on it, so you're thinking about putting fourth place insurance on it.
Well, what you would do is you would charge that back to the borrower, okay? So the servicer would set up an escrow and force an escrow account at that point. If they're not paying their insurance or taxes, typically the note holder is going to have to advance it ultimately. And then they would set up a escrow account and collect that from the borrower to cover that.
Can you force an escrow account?
You can't. Yes, okay, you can. So if they're not paying, it's always good to have an escrow. I mean, notes with escrows are great. In a lot of cases, borrowers only escrow for taxes. They don't always escrow for insurance. They pay their own insurance. And servicers allow them to do that. But either or, you can always force an escrow account. That's just mandatory. They have to pay taxes and insurance.
Okay.
Keith, the legal term for that, if you had to put insurance on it, right, because they didn't put insurance, So you had to put insurance on to protect your interest as the lien holder. That is referred to as a non-monetary default.
Okay.
Meaning that it's something other than the fact that they were paying you every month, but they were in violation of a covenant in the agreement.
Right. Okay. Well, that makes sense.
And what Charles is saying is that you have the right to demand that they reimburse you for that.
Well, it's usually in the mortgage or deed. But again, you know, when you're dealing with these seller finance notes, sometimes you have a very novice note seller.
Okay, wait a minute. You got to have it. I agree. If your deed of trust or your mortgage does not call for insurance, you got a problem.
Yeah.
I'm not arguing that. I'm just saying to you that you got it. I mean, we're making the presumption you got a good deed of trust. The deed of trust that Matt pulled up was a Fannie Mae form.
Yes.
You're good. It's in there.
And that's what you always want to make sure when you're doing due diligence. You know, look at those mortgages or those deeds of trust to make sure it is a Fannie Mae. Most people use a Fannie Mae or a relatively similar deed of trust, but. And if it's one they typed on a typewriter, then you might want to read through it.
Okay. All right. Well, yeah, that kind of brings me to the second question then. The Fannie Mae document that I actually supplied a copy of does call for an escrow up in item number 2. But as you move down the document, it kind of lets them off the hook, and it says, well, if they don't escrow, then they can just pay it direct. And so I'm slightly confused whether the Fannie Mae document mandates escrow or not.
No, they really don't. A lot of times the escrows are up to – a lot of times the lenders mandate that. Some lenders will require an escrow, some don't. I mean, won't require it necessarily. But it's not – typically Fannie Mae will allow you to pay your taxes and insurance, or the Fannie Mae form allows you to pay your own taxes and insurance. But once you default on that, if they ever force an escrow, then that's in place for the remainder of the loan. Generally, the lenders will not go back and release that escrow at that point.
Does that call for a legal action, I guess, to put that in place, a non-monetary default?
No.
No?
Well, yes, non-monetary default would, yes, but not to force the escrow. I mean, you wouldn't hire an attorney and just start trying to foreclose on them or for non-monetary default. You would have to go through as far as notifying the borrower that they have the option to pay the taxes or the insurance all in a whole, or you'll escrow it. They'll send a letter and give them a choice, either paying it in full or forcing an escrow. And then if the borrower doesn't come forward and pay it, then the lender will automatically set up the escrow.
Okay.
And then if they don't pay it, then they're in default.
That sounds like a legal action there, just to go ahead. If they're in default, then don't do it.
Yeah, key servicers deal with this. This is a normal course of action for servicers in our space.
Yeah.
Okay.
But it's a very good question.
All right. Thanks for the input.
Yeah. All right. Let's see, Charles. There's a couple of questions around that. I thought I'd catch those.
Okay.
Let's see here. If in a personal property trust, that's Dave Fernecki. I'm sorry. That was on the other last question. So what did you do with a non-monetary default with a 60-day late note? Start foreclosure? Ask if they want to start or go? Jackie asked that question. So I think, Charles, we need to draw a distinction in what is a borrower payment default and what is a non-monetary default.
Okay, so a borrower payment default is, Jackie, you've got a borrower that is not making their normal P&I payments or their payment on the loan. A non-monetary default is going to be something as we were discussing just now, as far as the escrow taxes, that is a requirement that they pay that or that they cover that. And so if they don't pay that, the property's at risk. So you have to go in there and pay those taxes or pay that insurance, and that's a non-monetary default. But a payment default strictly regarding the payment. Now, then, if the taxes and insurance are escrowed already, that's part of your principal interest in escrow payment, PITI. So that's a payment default. It's not necessarily non-payment. Non-monetary, that would be a payment default because there's escrow included in your payment.
So think of it in terms of this, Jackie. A non-monetary default is where somebody is in violation of something they've promised to do within the security agreement. They promise to keep the house insured. They promise to pay the taxes. They promise to protect the house. So if a hurricane comes along and the roof has a big hole in it, they're promising they're going to go up there and cover the roof up, right? So they're promising to protect your collateral, both of encumbrances and risks that would pass on to the lien holder. Here's another monetary default, Charles. What if I have a due on sale clause and I sell the house to somebody else?
Exactly.
So anything that is breaking a covenant that you have promised in the security agreement fall under a non-monetary default status. Am I saying that correct, Charles?
You are, yes.
Okay.
And if you ever look at a mortgage, there is a due on sale clause in there. And it does say that the lender for a non-monetary default, or such as one Andy talked about, is, you know, financing a house or selling a house that, you know, you're the first lien holder on, or they're holding the first lien. They can pursue the due on sale and call that note due. Now, will they do that? On something like that, may or may not, but on a tax insurance, they could.
Yeah. By the way, this is all normal stuff.
Yeah.
And if you own enough notes that are non-escrowed, and we buy notes all the time that aren't escrowed, but if you own a note, this can happen. And I can say, Charles, when's the last time you had to foreclose on somebody that didn't pay their insurance or taxes?
Eddie, I don't think I've ever foreclosed on anybody.
So it's.
I've never pursued it.
Yeah. So you have the right to get your money first. So. All right. What else?
All right. So last. We've got two more. Let me see if Keith has made it on. All right. Keith, go ahead.
Hello. How you doing?
Hey, Keith. What's up, buddy?
Oh, not much. I put some paperwork together. I sent it off to you guys to look at these 50-50 models so we can establish or show how we can establish a value on the cash flow basis. So I sent a few of them. I don't know if you got them, Matt, and if you want to just go through one or two of them, that'd be great just to show people how that works.
Which one you want to look at? I've got 317, 751, 101. 1762 and
you're driving a bus, man.
All right. So here we go. The first one on the list. So let me enlarge it.
There you go. Okay, so just to give a little background to everybody, so they know what's going on. I know me and you have talked about these things before, Eddie, but I have a client that has several homes bought up. Probably about a pool of 10 that I'm trying to put together and maybe see if these work for a 50-50 model. All of them are in reasonably good neighborhoods. The rents range from $700 to $1,000. The prices of houses range from probably, you know, $45,000 to $85,000. So I'm trying to come up with a program to show them, okay, on this particular house, although this house probably, I'd have to look at the comps on this one. I think this one's probably 55-ish for a actual comparable sales price. You know, how much is it worth on a cash flow basis, and will it work for a 50-50 model?
All right, so let's say that it's rent for $750 a month. What's the expenses going to run on it?
Well, if you look down there, the taxes are $1,300 a year. This is back in 11, so we could probably kick them $200, probably $1,500 a year.
All
insurance
right.
Insurance is going to be, you know, $80 a month, and then you're going to have your management fees.
All right. So Matt, run a quick calculation there. Take out 75 for management, 120 for taxes, and 80 for insurance. What's your net income per month?
Are you wanting a I was muted. You wanting to calculate the ROI, or are you wanting a?
No, just give me the net operating income on a monthly basis first. Let's see. Now I got my calculator up here. 750. Enter. So I got 475 a month. Keith.
Yep.
I'm going to multiply that times 12. That gives me an annualized net operating income of $5,700. If I sell that asset at an 11 cap rate, which is basically what a 50-50 model equates to, I'm selling that house for $51,800.
$51,800 would be your on the 50-50 model program.
Yeah. So I just kind of cut way through the chase, okay?
Yep.
I took your gross payment, I took out the expenses of taxes, insurance, and a management fee. Mm-hmm. I got to $475 a month net operating payment, and I annualized that. In other words, I multiplied it times 12.
Yep.
Okay? That got me to a number, and I divided it by 11%. That's
5,700 divided by 11.
5,700 divided by 11, and that got me to an annualized of what I could sell it for. That's saying that if an investor paid me $26,400 down, and I financed $26,400, there's what it is. Yeah, Matt, pull up your spreadsheet there. So, taxes put in 120. Tax insurance is $80. Take out other, and there you go. I can go a 10, 11, and a 12 cap rate. Just whatever. That's pretty quickly tells you what it's worth. So I did 11% because that's kind of how the 50-50 model is going to back into what the cap rate is.
Okay, now, Eddie, can you speak just a minute about the cap rate and why 11% is a better rate than a 9%? Because obviously if you look at your chart at 9%, you get more value for the house.
Well, once again, all this is somewhat subjective, but if you're asking me what they're selling turnkey properties for today, they're selling them from a 9 to 11 cap rate. That's what they're trading them for.
Okay.
You go look at the turnkey companies, that's what the market is. Mm-hmm. So cap rates are kind of a market condition. They're kind of like interest rates. People say, what kind of yield do you buy a note at? Well, what's the market? What kind of yields the market want? Right? You can't look it up in the Wall Street Journal. And that's the first thing I would do on any 50-50 candidate. This is not a great 50-50 candidate. And the reason is because the rent's not that good compared to what the value is, according to MLS.
Right.
So run that same math there, Matt. Pull up that spreadsheet. Do the same thing. There you go. It's a little nicer house, so go over there, Matt, and change 60 months to 6 years and see what it is at 6 years. So you're going to go up to probably about 53.5, my guess. No, 59,000 if you go out 7 years. So if you go out 7 years, you are selling it at a 9 cap.
Mm-hmm.
Now, am I saying absolutely with a nicer house in a nicer neighborhood, is that impossible? No, I can't really say that.
That's a 7 year.
Yeah, I don't think 7 years is realistic.
Yes, six years is still juiced it up good.
Yeah, that's a reasonable deal. But how many times, Keith, do you see these properties and you know it rents for $750 a month and you got a $38,000 BPO, right?
Yep.
That's too cheap.
Mm-hmm.
This is a deal where you're saying, well, $750, you take out the expenses and net operating income, $475 a month, it's $5,700 a year. It's a mid-50s house.
Yeah. So me and you have
a cap rate.
Yeah, me and you have had a conversation offline on this pool in general, and this is a typical house. Their rent maybe some of them may be at 8, some of them may be at 825. Is it worthwhile trying to put this all together, or should I just retail the houses?
I just tell you this right now. There ain't nothing else to do but take all these houses and lay them out on a spreadsheet and run a cap rate and figure out where you are. Run the expenses, take the net operating income, annualize it, and take it and back into a cap rate. There's nothing else to do. It's just running a mathematical equation to figure out whether there's a value buy and doing the 50-50.
Mm-hmm.
The 50-50 doesn't make sense if you're going to make the house sell for $3,000 more. You can make it sell for $23,000 more. It makes sense.
Right. All right. Well, that's what I'm going to do is look at them all and then see if I can talk to them about using the model if the numbers work.
And what I'm seeing is like even you're in the Detroit metro area. I mean, like, what would this house have been worth 3 years ago?
$35,000.
There you go. That house has gone up that much in 3 years. That's because it was too dang cheap. And all of you guys that are freaking out about buying in the Rust Belt, I'm telling you, that's the cheapest real estate in the business right now. That crap is not going to stay that cheap. Will it, Charles?
No way. We're going to see them going up.
That's why we're so hot on it.
Yeah.
Okay, well, hopefully that helps some other folks work through this 50-50 model.
Beautiful. Thank you for putting it up there.
All right.
All right. Okay. Mr. Matt, what else?
Last up's a question from Lisa. She is, from last time, we found out she was naughty because Santa didn't bring her mic, so she must be really naughty because it's still not there. So,
better luck next year, Lisa.
So she had a kind of a question about forming a meetup group, and she's doing this coming Friday, and I'll just read the question off real quick. So she's formed a group for notes and investing, and she would appreciate a little bit of guidelines from others of what they have done and what they have experienced. So far she has 12 people attending, and some of whom she already knows. What she wants to do is deliver value and content / exposure to the business without teaching people how to do notes. She made a point that's what note school is for. And she doesn't want to appear as if she's soliciting business. So she's wanting some hints and feedback to make this meetup a successful one that will grow as well in the future.
Well, here's what I would say. I think to start out, I don't think you need some PowerPoint presentation. I mean, we've got stuff on the website she can use, but honest to God, I wouldn't do it. I'd just say, you know, here's something. I'd just say, let me tell you a little bit about what I've done. I was predominantly a real estate investor, and now I've switched gears, and I've been buying notes, and here's what I like about it. And I earn as good or better return, and I have a lot less aggravation. You know, it lets me be the bank, and the bank's got a lot lot less management role than the landlord. And I like it, and it suits me well. And, you know, I'll just sort of open it up, and you guys can do whatever. And that's how I would go about it. You know, down the road, if you're, like, in meeting number three and you want to do some kind of presentation and talk about that stuff, it's fine. But I'm just saying the non-slick factor is everything. Martha and I had a lengthy meeting today with a self-directed IRA company, and they're going to do, like, a meetup with us. And we had the very same conversation. I mean, it's like, you know, just you're just trying to get people comfortable. So it's ironic. I didn't know Lisa had submitted this at the time that I was at that meeting today. But that's exactly what we're doing. Martha's doing. It's just like we just tell a little story. And, wow, 17 attendees. Lisa, listen, you're going to kill it doing this. Just be yourself. Just be yourself. You're good. You're very knowledgeable. You can talk the business. You've heard me say and explain things a lot of times, and I've heard you say it and explain it. You're very comfortable with people. You're going to kill it. It's just a non-slick factor deal. That's just it. Somebody wants to pull you aside after the fact and say, tell me more about how that works. You got to train them. No, you're not running three-day classes, and you're not running a mentorship like Note School does. But you got to teach them enough to feel comfortable with the deal. You are educating them. Absolutely, you're educating them.
And this could be a great avenue for, like, partial buyers. I mean, investors that may want to just be non-passive investors and buy partial investments, Eddie.
Yep. Yeah. No, I think it's fine. I mean, get your mic because I want to talk to you about this as it happens next week. But, Lisa, the first thing I do is it's just non-slick. You know, go buy you a pack of Oreos so everybody's got an Oreo to chip up, to nibble on while you're talking to them.
Where are you having this at, Lisa? Starbucks?
They don't have Starbucks in California.
The Chinese Seattle. Buffet. Oh, no. That's what Ray said.
Yeah. Bring the tequila. Damn right. Bring the tequila. That's always a fix right there.
Yeah.
Oh, Chinese buffet. Let's see. Dave Fernecki asked what time is the best time to do it. Well, normally they're in the evening, but I don't know. The Winberries have a meetup that has over 100 people that show up every week, and it's like 9 till 11 on Wednesdays, you know, during the daytime. Go figure.
People just put it on their schedule.
Yeah. Yeah, Lisa's doing it at a lunchtime buffet place. And she's got a private room in the back. That's a very good idea. A lot of people do that.
Yeah.
Works out good. Yeah. Lisa, just go be yourself. You don't need a PowerPoint light show. We'll wire you up with all kind of that stuff down the road. But truth matters right now. Just go be yourself and just tell them about the business, why you like it. And that's the winningest combination in the world. What do you say? You say the same thing that you guys hear me say in classes and Kevin says and stuff we say on the – it's like people say, how do I learn to speak a language? You just got to listen to people speak the language, and that's what I think. Probably – to me, Charles, that's probably the greatest benefit of what we do on these webinars every week as far as dealing with investors. You just learn to speak it in a way people can follow it.
Right. That's exactly right, Eddie.
Yeah. Yeah, Robin wants to know, what do you say without being a salesperson? Robin, you know, one of the biggest things that I really think that I helped Martha do is, Martha, you're not selling. You're just talking about what you do. You're telling a story. Let me tell you something. I spent, in the last 18 months, I spent $25,000 or $30,000 in speaker training for either myself or Joe or Kevin or somebody. Okay? I spent $30,000 on speaker training. More than most of you paid for a mentorship that lasts for life or whatever. Okay? And I will tell you this. Stories sell and compel. Spreadsheets confuse. Funny is money. Stories sell. Just tell a story.
Exactly.
Charles, we got a spreadsheet coming out tomorrow, a tape.
Got a spreadsheet coming out tomorrow for everybody. It'll be posted tomorrow afternoon after the non-performing call, so about 5:30, Matt will have that spreadsheet up. So that should have a pretty good amount of assets on there, and so just get on there tomorrow afternoon, take a look at it, and let us know if you want to buy any of the assets.
Yeah. All right, guys, great call tonight. Man, if we could have this type of content every week, I would be it's good. I asked you for a big commitment to start bringing really cool stuff to the call, and I think you, not that you haven't in the past, but you know, I think this year we've been on a good roll, and I see it continuing. So, look, guys, talking to about these investors and interacting and stuff, I see this being a very big part of the call, and interfacing you know, we're out there doing that, and Martha's doing it here in Dallas Fort Worth. So, you know, whatever we do, we'll be totally transparent with you and just tell you to do it. But I'm just telling you, it's just telling a story. It's not selling. It's no hooks. It's no trip switches. Nothing like that. It's just telling a story, and stories compel. So, all right, Mr. Mangan, I will see you early at the airport.
See you early at the airport, Eddie. Everybody,
right,
have
guys,
a great evening.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night.